This morning, the esteemed Mr. Burberry.
That's me.
May fess up to the fact that he hasn't been able to find time in his voluminous 24 hours to respond to all the emails he's getting now that he's made himself an expert.
Yeah, stop sending them.
Yeah. Don't send any more emails. You will be ignored.
No, my ISP will start complaining.
Yeah, right. The way they complain is they bill you higher.
Yeah.
I hate that type of complaint.
Well, you're the only other person, Michael, besides Nick himself, that confesses to doing the red tincture.
There are several others I know of that have done it.
And I know of no one who responded to the poll. About 100 people did. No one but Nick and you responded that they had the red tincture. But I'm sure other people have produced it.
It's not so hard.
And that's what I'm gathering. And that's the exciting thing, I think, that I found out in the last 6 months, I guess, since Barry was here and such, is that this is I had never produced precipitate from sand or done any appreciable wet precipitate. And since Barry has been here, I'm doing it every day and producing it every month, and it really has helped a lot. In spite
of when you make it yourself, it's a big difference to what you can buy.
Oh, I believe so too. Even the so-called pitiful wet precipitate is much better when it has your own energetic vibration and signature to it.
Yes.
Hell yeah. It's another beautiful cloudy day here in Queensland.
And it's very hot down here in Sydney.
Is it?
Yes.
I've been experimenting with this creation that we've had. We're having the coolest summer ever, especially for me on the Gold Coast, and day after cloudy day.
Tell them about White Christmas.
Huh?
Tell them about White Christmas.
Yeah. I had one of my warmest friends ring me on Christmas Day and said, "Den, you've overdone it. It's a cold, miserably cold Christmas Day." Now, just for you guys, you know, because you guys probably wouldn't know that Christmas Day in the Southern Hemisphere is like the 25th of June in the Northern Hemisphere. And on Christmas Day, in five different locations around Australia, they got snow. Now, just imagine what likelihood are you going to have of having snow on Christmas Day? No, having snow on the 25th of June?
Yeah. realizing that Melbourne is what, about the latitude of California?
Yeah. That's right. Melbourne's about the latitude of San Francisco?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard our president say that he doesn't believe in global warming.
Yeah. And he thinks it's confined to his electric blanket.
It's curious, though. We've filed for endangered status for polar bears because they don't have pack ice to be on. But we don't believe in the global warming that melted the pack.
Right. Actually, I'm not anti-Bush. I'm just pro-intelligence.
Well, I think they ought to pass an Endangered Species Act for the present administration.
Yeah, right.
2 years from today, he's gone.
We've just had a few people come onto the call. Tell us who you are and welcome yourself in.
Greetings, Dennis. This is Adam from Ashland, Oregon. Hi, all.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, the greetings one.
Hi, Adam.
Haven't had a good greet for weeks.
It seems like we were just talking.
Yeah, it was just moments ago. And who else we got?
Janine from Mandeville.
Hey, Janine.
Welcome you
back.
Can hear me? Oh, thank
yeah,
you.
Darling.
Hey, and I was so inspired the last time Michael spoke that I ordered my own lye, pH testing papers, and some Dead Sea salt.
Correct.
I'm going to make my own. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
How about you, Barry? Is it freezing in Eastern Oregon?
Oh, it's actually exactly freezing right now.
That's not what I thought, yeah. Same here in Western Oregon.
Yeah. It's been below freezing a lot most of the time. This is a nice warm day. Did y'all see the pictures of the plants that survived freezing?
No. I thought that was fascinating.
We've had some four different people, me being one of them, who have plants that they put ormus on, and the plants didn't remain green all winter, despite repeated freezing.
Yeah, John Maluski was reporting that same thing a couple of seasons ago.
Yeah.
I had a fig tree here in Oklahoma. It's not a great area of the country for the type of fig I have, and it's put on figs in the winter and survived it once, but it's not staying green all year. It usually goes through two cycles of growth each year and two fruiting cycles, but it has survived the winters without too much problem.
Awesome.
I mulched a little with straw, but I have had fruit on it with snow and ice at the same time one season. It hasn't done that every year. But
is it? Have you put ormus on it, or this is just natural?
Partial. Not. I don't do it daily. A lot of it I just allow natural growth. But when I have fertilizer, there's always been something with that. And I don't overdo it. I just have been trying to give it just something when it looks like it needs a little spurt.
Uh-huh.
Last year I transplanted it from one house to another, and I did not do anything for a season just to let it get kind of reestablished. So.
Yeah. Well, the seawater precipitate is supposed to help with the transplants as well.
I had to cut the taproot. I thought I was going to lose it.
Oh, wow.
Down under my house foundation, and then to get it out and be able to move it, we had to cut a significant portion of it. And everybody I know in the gardening field said it would be gone when I moved it, plus the stress of moving it, but it did survive it. So.
Was it tapped into your sewer?
No, it had just gone under the foundation, and we couldn't dig down deep enough to get it out. So we ended up having to break about, the taproot was about 2.5 inches thick. We had to cut it off a significant portion of it to get it out. So. But it survived that, and that was miraculous, according to some of the folks around here.
Last time we had this phenomenal call, which got cut off at the end, and some of us managed to struggle back in. And we were sort of going to continue where we were last time, except Michael and I can't even remember where we were last time. So it would appear that we're going to make it up as we go. Hey, Michael, do you have anything in particular you want to do a little rave about?
Well, before we get into questions, I was thinking maybe we could go over the salt precipitate method, and then perhaps a hydrochloric and hydrogen peroxide method, and then take some questions after that.
Great. Now, just before you get started, I'll just do my little administration. If you're having any sound in the background, please hit *6, and that will mute you. And then if you want to pipe up and ask a question, hit *7, and that will unmute you. Just remember, if you're unmuted, the neighbors mowing the lawn will go around the world for the whole call. So, Michael, please be the guest of the moment and launch.
Okay. Michael Burberry from Sydney. Most of you have probably seen my messages on the list. This morning, I think I'd like to start with the salt precipitate method that I quite like doing. Takes me about 5 to 6 days to actually do it right. I generally do not dry the precipitate. I like to keep it wet. I also store it in brown 100ml bottles. To start the procedure, I have an 8-litre container, 8 litres in gallons. Dennis, 2.5? About 2.5 gallons?
Yeah.
And in that, I mix in either the Sanders Atlantic sea salt or my favourite Horizon salt. I add about 1 kilo of salt to the 8 litres of water. Half kilo. They come in 250-gram packets. Sorry, just picking one up and checking it. Add half a kilo of salt, mix it in with a nice wooden spoon, and then I have a separate glass that I mix my sodium hydroxide in. The one I use is the Diggers brand. It's available in Australia, but I'm sure there's plenty of brands out there. I quite like the Diggers brand because they actually make it from a salt just down south of us, and the salt they get there is extremely clean. I've actually seen the salt lake that they take it from, and the water in there, you can see the bottom when it's 30 foot deep.
While you're on that subject, Michael, I'm not familiar with the process of how sodium hydroxide is made.
Oh, it's done through electrolysis of salt. Similar to electroplating, they put an anode and cathode into a salt water solution, and I believe on the cathode side, the sodium hydroxide forms, and on the anode side, it bubbles off chlorine gas. They then also take the chlorine gas to make chlorine for pools from, so they don't actually waste anything. The plant they do it in down there is huge. They have plates all over the place that are making the sodium hydroxide and chlorine gas at the same time. The amount of power it takes is generally around 12 volts at about 3,500 amps. So there is quite a lot of power used to make it. And then they, just basically scrape the sodium hydroxide off the plates and package it and sell it.
So therefore, it's a quality and clarity of the initial salt water that's an issue.
Yes. As long as the salt water is clean, it keeps all the equipment clean. That's why they do it down at this particular salt lake down south. Okay. So basically, sodium hydroxide is made from salt water as well. So basically, we're adding salt to salt water, in a manner of speaking. And anyway, I grab the sodium hydroxide. I measure out 120 millilitres of water and mix in 15 grams of the caustic soda or sodium hydroxide into that water. Do it very slowly because it gets quite hot very quickly, and stir it with a stainless steel stirrer. Stainless steel being the best implement to use in caustic soda. It doesn't ionize very easily, so you can maintain stirring it while dropping in the sodium hydroxide crystal slowly, and just keep an eye on the temperature of the container you're doing it in, because if you do it too quickly, it can shatter and makes a huge mess, which I've done. So also a good trick is if you have a plastic container about, actually put your flask or container or glass into that plastic container. So if it does shatter, it just stays inside that plastic container and not go all over your table and everything else.
Yeah, because if you're not careful and you happen to spill that and you're in front of a whole group of people and you have to take your pants off immediately, it's embarrassing.
Well, having not been there, I'll take your word for it.
I
hope you can continue to take my word for it.
Okay, once I've measured out the 120 mil with the 15 grams of caustic soda, that's about an 8-to-1 ratio. The pH is well over. It's extremely high. It is actually very caustic, so make sure you wear kitchen gloves or my personal preference are electroplating gloves. And I then use a plastic syringe and measure out 20...
And eye protection.
Yes, eye protection as well if you have it.
Absolutely crucial.
Okay.
Get it in your eyes, it'll blind you.
Yeah, just being near the fumes can make your eyes sting as well, so good eyewear is actually quite beneficial. I also prefer to wear a plastic apron as well when I'm working on this type of stuff. Having worked in the electroplating industry and spilled acids on me before, I know how painful it can be. So, yeah, wearing a plastic apron over the front of you as well, just in case you have any spillages, can actually protect your skin. It's actually very beneficial as well. Okay, from the sodium hydroxide solution, which is about an 8-to-1 mixture, I generally let it sit there for a couple of hours and let it cool down as well, because it does get very warm when you mix that up. And after a couple of hours, when it has cooled down, I use a plastic syringe and I measure out 27 millilitres of the sodium hydroxide and slowly drop that into the salt water container while stirring it quite briskly with the wooden spoon I have until it goes a nice smoky colour. And then I use my digital pH meter, and since I've done this so often, the 27 mil of the sodium hydroxide in the 8 litres of salt water generally brings the pH up to 10.5. So mine is kind of more of a recipe. I guess that's just because I've done it so often, I know basically how much of each component to use. I guess when people are first trying it out, just drop her in some of your sodium hydroxide and measure the pH, and be careful, because once it goes over a pH of about 9.5, it rises very quickly.
Jumps quick, eh?
Yeah, it takes quite a while to get to 9.5, but once you get over 9.5, it'll go to 10.5 very quickly. Okay, generally don't
I've
go
had
over...
a few whoops moments.
Oh, yes. If you do have a whoops and it goes over 10.7 or 10.8, you've got to also take into account that your pH meter is generally only accurate to about 0.1, unless you've got a really expensive one, which I can't afford. So mine's got an accuracy of about 0.1. If I could take it up to more than 10.6 or 10.7, I generally throw it out and start again. I mean, salt's not very expensive, so just throw it out and start again. I generally don't like raising it up more than 10.5, and it's
throw
actually
it out
very.
On your plant.
Sorry?
Throw it out on your plant.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I throw it on my lawn. Actually, I've stopped doing that now because I've had to mow the lawn so often.
Yeah.
Especially with a little patch around the back door.
I'd spray it out all over the lawn, and it got to a stage where the lawn was growing like 3 inches a week, so I stopped doing that. Anyway, moving on. Once you bring up the pH to 10.5 and it goes that nice smoky colour, I generally seal it. My flask here has a sealable lid. It's also made of a Pyrex glass, and it actually has a screw-down sealable lid. And I actually screw that down and actually seal it, and then I generally put it into a special box that I've made, which is actually made out of bismuth. Bismuth is a diamagnetic material that reflects all radio frequency waves, and I put it into that dark box and let it precipitate for about 2 days on the first attempt, and let it all settle down and actually form the layer across the bottom of the precipitate. And then I take it out of that box, and it's been in the dark there for 2 days, and use a plastic tube that I got from a hardware store to siphon off the water. I siphoned off the water into a jerry can, because I do use that as well in other procedures, mainly because I can recover the sodium hydroxide from it. But that's just because I don't like buying it. It's too expensive. But anyway, once I've siphoned the water off, I generally top it up with fresh spring water and let it sit for another 24 hours. At that time, I don't generally put it back into the bismuth box. I just cover it with a sheet or some paper, or at the moment it's a jacket, old jacket, just to keep the light away from it and let it precipitate for about 24 hours. and then repeat that over the next 3 days. You just basically drain the water off, add new water, let it sit there for a day, and then the next day do the same thing. So you've actually washed it, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 times.
That's a lot of washes.
Yes.
How long
That's
does this
my preference.
How long does this precipitate last you?
From the 8 litres, about 7 to 8 days.
Now, how much precipitate do you get out of 8 litres?
I put some photos up on the Ormus Yahoo group, so you can view it. But I would say about 50 grams.
Of dried precipitate?
Yes. Oh, not dry. No, that would be wet. Dry would be closer to 30.
How many, so 50 milliliters?
Yes. About 2.5 inches in a nice cup that I have.
That doesn't seem like very much from...
Half a kilo of salt?
Yeah.
Well, seems quite good to me.
I've
tried lots
morning.
Of different salts. I'm sure there are some good mineral salts like the Himalayan ones, but they're rather expensive, whereas the Horizon salt is actually quite cheap, and the Sanders Atlantic salt, which I do get more precipitate from, is also quite cheap.
But you like the Horizon better?
Yeah, mainly because the salt crystals grow in a pyramid shape. They're not cubic. Which actually means that the minerals in there are tetrahedral minerals that cause the salt to grow in that shape.
And what would that indicate to you, Michael?
Tetrahedral minerals. Basically, if you have a look at, for instance, Bob's Rock Shop, and I know Bob's on the list. I don't know if he joins the calls very often. But if you have a look in there and you look at the different rocks that he's selling, the mineral rocks that grow in a tetrahedral shape are generally things like cobalt, rhodium, I believe copper. I had a list, but I haven't got the list in front of me at the moment.
So you
okay?
think it's a different mix of Ormus elements?
Yes.
Very good.
Yes. I do know that good sea salts, and it varies around the world as well, which is why I quite like the Sanders Atlantic sea salt. That one, they had it checked, and on their website it says there's 84 minerals in it. If you go to different places around the world and buy different salts, they have different levels of different types of minerals. So even though the sea covers the entire world, the minerals in the salt change constantly as the seawater is flowing around the world.
Yeah, one of our early guests, Don Nance, maintained that the Pacific Ocean was the best ocean water for making Ormus, which kind of, my immediate question was, well, why are you living in Florida then and using Atlantic water? But anyway, that was, I never mentioned that. The reason I say that is that it would appear that the ocean water has got lots of different flavors. What's your observation on that, Michael?
Well, actually, I went up to far north Queensland and out to the coral reefs.
Yeah.
And, I actually collected some of the salt water from the coral reef, and the precipitate from that was actually a brownish colour. And the only thing I could attribute that to was probably high levels of selenium, which tends to oxidise very quickly and goes a brown colour. So, yeah, I definitely agree that as the water flows around, it does change the amount of minerals in the water quite dramatically. As you head down south, the level of minerals in the water actually depletes quite rapidly as compared to going up north in Australia. So you're actually quite lucky, Dennis. Up north there, you actually get a lot more than what people down south would.
Arthur has noticed pretty much the same thing. He gets a totally different result from the precipitate collected in one part of the Pacific coast of America versus another part.
And it's interesting because we've had quite a bit of feedback about the Hong Kong Sea, where Sigverta is usually on the corner. He might be in lurking mode today. And if you're on Sigverta, say hello. He was telling us how he gets the water off the Hong Kong Islands, and which has a hugely different quality again from because Don Natz talked about the Pacific Ocean being basically surrounded by what he called the ring of fire or the huge volcanic activity that's really present in the Pacific Ocean more so than any other. I suppose that would contribute to a huge amount of mineralization. What do you think, Michael?
Yes, that volcanic action is actually further up north than it is down south. Down south along the continental shelf there, it's actually very quiet. But up north, yeah, there is quite a bit of activity.
Sheikh Berta gets his salt water from a lake in Tibet.
Yeah, I know that. He just made mention of occasionally he'll get some water from the Hong Kong Sea.
Is the Horizon Salt an Australian company?
Yes, it is.
So you know the source comes from inland in Australia, you said?
Yes, it comes from a flat plain in Victoria that has one lone hill in the middle of the flat plain in the shape of a pyramid with a rather original Aboriginal Dreamtime story about it as well. But yes, it's an underground saline lake that runs underneath that pyramid hill.
Wow.
Okay, moving on. Once I have separated the water from the precipitates, I generally move it to a smaller flask. The smaller flask I have is about 2.5 litres, which I believe is about 1 gallon, Dennis? A bit less than 1 gallon.
Yeah.
Anyway, I move the precipitate into that separate flask. It stands about a foot tall and about 7 or 8 centimetres round cylindrical cylinder. And I place the precipitates into that. And then I pop down to the supermarket and buy my favorite white wine vinegar. And I get that in a 3-litre plastic container, of which I put that plastic container directly into the freezer and let it freeze overnight. After the white wine vinegar is frozen overnight in the freezer, I then take the lid off and basically... while pushing my finger onto the block of ice in the middle of it, I pour out the rather concentrated vinegar into a smaller flask and then use a 10-mil syringe and measure out 7 mil of that and drop it slowly into the precipitates I have into the smaller flask that I just put it in and let it dissolve again into that very strong white wine vinegar. Once it has dissolved again, it tends to go a slight pale yellow color, at which point
Why?
I will then... Sorry?
Why?
Why? Not sure. Yeah. Not sure, but it does definitely go a slight pale yellow color.
Okay.
Especially with the Atlantic salt. The Atlantic salt goes a much deeper yellow, but even with the Horizon salt, a very slight pale yellow color. At which point I'll top it up again with water until it's about 2/3 full, and then again after it has dissolved and stirred about and let sit for about an hour or so, I'll then measure out 15 mil of my concentrated sodium hydroxide solution that I made previously in the 8-to-1 ratio, and slowly drop that into the concentrated vinegar and water and the precipitates in the smaller flask and stir that in very slowly and only bring up the pH to about 9.2. At the pH of 9.2, the precipitates will start dropping out again, but instead of being a bright white color, they're actually almost see-through crystals.
And how do you see it?
Sorry? They actually form... Like they clump together in like very small clouds and just slowly drift down to the bottom.
Now, why do you do that, and why do you think that this minimizes magnesium or other elements that aren't on this?
It's a method I prefer because I do actually think it reduces calcium and magnesium. Yes,
uh-huh.
Only to a certain degree though, because even magnesium tends to precipitate at a 9.2 range, though a lot of people say it's 9.5. I have been able to get magnesium to precipitate at 9.2, but generally in very small amounts.
And do you think that the M state will mostly precipitate out, or are you losing a bit of it?
No, I'm quite sure that you are losing some as well. but it is a reduction technique.
Mm-hmm.
Because once that is done, the amount of precipitate you left from your half a kilo of salt is generally around 10 to 12 grams.
I see. Versus 80, I think, is what you said, right?
Yeah, about 50 before.
50.
Yeah. It's been significantly more reduced. And it's very light, and it only gently floats down. It takes a good 2 to 3 days to settle. And even whilst it's settling, it rises up to the top and then falls down the bottom again. It's actually quite unique to watch. So after about 2 to 3 days, when it does eventually settle out, and it does eventually, I then just gently siphon off that water and separate what's left of that precipitate and then wash it 2 more times in water, again allowing it to stand for a good day to let it precipitate down again. So now I'm up to about day 6 in the process. And at which time I'll drain the water off, and I generally store it in 100ml brown bottles. And that's my usual ormus that I have in the morning. It's one of my favorites I enjoy in the morning. Generally about 1 teaspoon into a glass of water, and just drink that before I head off to work. It's gives you a great energy for the day.
You've made ormus, the white powder, of a rather large number of elements. And you've eaten most of those, right?
Yes.
And yet you still prefer the seawater precipitate?
Yes.
What is the difference? Why do you prefer the seawater precipitate?
To be honest with you, I personally don't think there is any difference to what you get from salt to processing a metal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just when you process a metal, you only have that metal's ormus. But when you process a salt, you have all the elements that were in that salt as your ormus.
And from my point of view, that's a huge difference. That's actually much more benefit.
Yeah, I do very much prefer to have a salt precipitate than I would making gold through the hydrochloric hydrogen peroxide method.
Can you tell the... You can really tell the difference in the way it feels.
Yes. Yes, I get a lot more energy from taking a salt precipitate ormus done in the method I just described than I would doing the gold method with the hydrogen peroxide. Actually, the gold method with hydrogen peroxide, the white powder you produce of gold, you have very small amounts of it, but it makes me feel dizzy.
Yeah, me too.
And that's not what I want. The salt precipitates make me feel, I don't know, the best way to describe it is to say alive. I've got abundant amount of energy to go and do things.
Which is absolutely apparent because I'm completely bloody and monkey managed to fit in as many posts and many research links as you do. As a family man who's also holding down a bloody job, I'm going, does he sleep?
Yes, I do sleep, but I have a great deal of energy. And I love the energy it gives you. I mean, that's the reason I have it every morning. It's the energy. It's hard to describe because you can sit there and drink a dozen cups of coffee and afterwards you feel awake, but you don't feel energized. You can drink that Red Bull stuff, which I absolutely hate. And again, you feel awake, but you don't feel energized. This is completely different. You feel like you have a lot of energy to spend, like you could run around the block 10 times and not even be out of breath.
Ormus gives you wings.
The new slogan.
Excuse me, Michael, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
I didn't quite follow the very last part of that. You say you've... put the 15 mLs of sodium hydroxide, bring up the pH to 9.2, you get 10 to 12 grams of precipitant, you let that settle, you do 2 more washes with water, and then the numbers, I didn't quite follow, when you had 1 teaspoon, what you were getting 1 teaspoon, you dry it?
Oh, okay, sorry. After I've washed it the second time and I let it precipitate down, I drain off all the water. I've got a plastic tube here that I have the ability. I actually hold it to the side of the flask with a clothes peg, so it's not high technology here. but I let the tube go right down, so it's only about half a centimeter or 5 mil above the precipitate. So I can drain the water right down until it's only half a centimeter or 5 mil of water left over the top of the precipitate, and that's it. That's the end product for me.
Okay. So it's not much water, mostly precipitate.
Correct.
Thank you.
And it's very light. It's quite translucent, see-through, clear, like gel-type substance.
So at 1 teaspoon daily, how long does that last?
1 teaspoon a day, it lasts me about 5 days. Takes 6 days to make. Eat it in 5 days. So you do many at the same time, don't you?
I guess so.
I'm lucky here. I've got about a dozen of these flasks all going at once. So, I mean, most of the time is waiting. You're waiting for it to precipitate. So it is actually quite easy to run several at the same time. But I can only
Do you do this? Is timing a factor for you? Like, I always do mine in the moon phases. Do you?
Yes. I generally make it on the first week of the waning moon for the first precipitation. So the 8-litre container that I do the first precipitation in, I generally do that on the first week of the waning moon, but I'll do it for each day. So I'm actually making six of them. Okay. So I'm actually making six of them on that first week.
Okay.
After that, I don't think it matters so much.
Would it be easier to do it all in one container?
I've tried that, and I do have a rather large container here, but it's awkward to work with. It's actually easier to do it in multiple smaller ones. It's just less awkward, that's all.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't see any reason. I mean, Dennis does his in a 30-litre bucket, don't you, Dennis?
Hell yeah, I wouldn't think of anything less.
Well, Dennis does his in a 30-litre container. I do mine in about 4 or 5 8-litre containers, which is about the same amount.
I've done it in a 200-litre container.
There you go.
Carol.
Is that like a 44-gallon drum?
55.
Wow.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
This is Marty Cook in Salt Lake City. The question that I have was, you had mentioned keeping the liquid from the very first, when you were precipitating, because you said you reused it to get your sodium hydroxide out of the gin.
Yes.
I was just wondering how you do this.
Electrolysis. I worked as an electroplater for many years, so basically I hook up a couple of car batteries. Actually, there's 12 car batteries all hooked up in parallel. Each car battery pushes about 50 amps, so 12 times 50, that's quite a few amps. And yeah, I have 2 titanium plates, and I put the titanium plates into the water and basically electrolyze the water. Chlorine gas bubbles off the anode. The sodium hydroxide reforms on the other side that you just scrape off and reuse.
Okay. And my other question would be that I have heard of most people doing the swing before, like with the very first precipitate, and then they re-precipitate it with the vinegar and all that stuff. You do it after you've washed it the first 4 times.
Yes.
What would you say would be the difference in doing it after the washes as opposed to before the washes?
Okay, again, white wine vinegar, even when you freeze it and pour it out and it's concentrated, it's actually quite a strong acid. And one of the things I don't particularly like is having the solutions warm. I think the solutions should actually run no warmer than room temperature. And if you start adding a strong acid to a precipitate that was just done where the pH was still high, it's going to warm up the solution.
Now, why is that? Why do you prefer running it cold?
It's personal preference, I guess. I do a lot of the electroplating that I've done in the past, the solutions, it's actually quite important to keep them at room temperature, otherwise they just don't work.
Huh.
Other solutions, like the chromic acid tank where you do your chrome plating in, has to run at 80 degrees. Mm-hmm. But most of the other solutions, particularly in gold plating, the temperature of the tank actually cannot be any higher than 25 degrees.
I prefer to boil my water and then precipitate it hot.
In a warm solution?
Yeah. Now, I don't know why I prefer that, and I don't know that that's a good way to do it, but it you can move pretty quickly, and you don't have to wait for the lag time for the pH meter to register.
That's true. Have you tried it at cooler temperatures, Barry?
Yes.
Do you generally get more at the cooler temperatures than you do at the higher?
I haven't noticed that.
Okay.
It usually is about the same. I get about, with Pacific Ocean water, I get about one-fifth. One-fifth of the total volume of water as precipitate after settling overnight. With cold, it takes a longer to settle to that level.
Yes. Well, like I said, it basically just comes from the solutions I used to work with in electroplating, where it was very specific that the temperature couldn't be over a certain amount and it couldn't be under a certain amount.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's just been bred into me, so that's the way I prefer to do it.
Well, I there may be an advantage. It's hard to say.
Yeah, I must admit, I must. Actually, I will. I'll grab some of mine, and I'll stick it on a hot plate, and I'll bring up the temperature to about 60, and let's see how it goes.
Yeah,
worth a try. Though I hadn't considered it before.
So that's the end process for your sea salt and horizon salt precipitates.
Yes, I use the precipitates. I mean, not just to consume. I use them for other things as well. One of the things
because that's a lot longer process than I use. I mean, I'm one of those people that I like mine short and sweet and effective and fast, and the least amount of time I can spend it, the better.
Okay.
What is the perceived advantage of going through the extra steps with the vinegar?
To be honest with you, if I have the precipitate without going through the vinegar, I actually don't feel as much energy as I do after going through the vinegar process.
I'm going to have to have a go at this then.
Yeah, oh, definitely. You should give it a try. It's actually really good. You'd be quite surprised.
All right. I'm enrolled.
I mean, previously
okay,
I've never...
I have one question.
Sure.
Okay. What would be the difference in just using the regular vinegar without doing the freeze? I mean, I realize that it's more concentrated, but... But if you just use regular vinegar?
Then you need to use a lot more, and you're going to need a bigger flask.
Okay.
That's all. That's all it is.
All right. Thank you.
Basically, the vinegar that you're buying from the supermarket is about 75% water. So freezing it just basically separates out the water. Then you can use a smaller flask, and you use less of the vinegar.
Could you use HCl?
You could. I prefer not to. I personally haven't used hydrochloric with salt precipitates. I like to try and keep that process as fairly much natural as I can.
So do you assign cause to the difference with vinegar in any particular way? I mean, let me ask you that question a little bit more elegantly.
Thank you.
Do you think is the difference that makes a difference in this case?
Oh, well, using the vinegar on the precipitate in the second part of the method, I believe actually reduces the amount of calcium and magnesium in the precipitate. It also does make the precipitate a lot more translucent and cloudy and light. And in my opinion, I think that's easier to ingest than the thick, white, gluggy stuff. I mean,
for the purposes of doing it in my containers, you know, my 30 and 20-litre containers, quite often I do two at once.
Sure.
So I make 50 litres at one time. When you use the vinegar, rather than for my first go through, the measurements will be different. Do you drop it down to a specific pH?
Yes, I generally, like I said, I use 15 mil. That brings the pH down to about 2. Generally
two.
About 2.
Well, I was saying for
1.
2.
Yeah, and given the amount that you got, Dennis, just grab the whole 3-litre white wine vinegar and just pour it all in. That should take it down to about 2. Well, you got quite a lot there. You're going to be using a lot.
Yeah. All right, that's on my agenda this very month.
Oh, good stuff. Let us know how you go.
You mentioned last week, the last time, that you did some work with, you collected dew and you got a precipitate from it, and that precipitate levitated away from your hand?
That's actually a very, very long process. I have one in the works at the moment. It's just behind my laptop here.
Uh-huh.
Let's have a look at it. Yeah, it's coming along quite nicely. Basically, if you collect dew water, in this case, I've got about 2 liters of dew water there.
Mm-hmm.
It's been sitting there now for about, 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fermenting. Dew water does ferment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, mine fermented too.
Yep. So you do need to let it actually sit there and ferment for a good, well, I think 4 months is actually quite adequate, but I'm going for 6 months on this one. I want to try and get as much of the gur out as possible.
And doesn't your computer freak it out?
The laptop? No.
Yeah. I can. It's almost like I hear my Ormus wanting to be moved away from the computer. But if I ever bring some Ormus in and sit it by my computer on my desk, I can kind of feel it tugging at me to go, move me, move me. In fact, it. Here's an outrageous story for you. You wouldn't know this, Michael, but one of our guests was Danae Harding. And she's got some remarkable stuff called the Spark of Life water, and she also had some a special golden solution. And I put that down by my laptop, and my laptop was actually overpowered by Danae's solution to the point where it cost me a $300 hard drive.
Ouch.
I kid you not. I was going to ring up and complain, but I figured that would get me nowhere.
What, to the people that made the laptop?
No, to Danae about the power of her Ormus. It was like,
right.
Normally Ormus gets freaked out by the computers, but this stuff just overpowered my computer. I was just sitting next to it for an hour or so. Yeah, I won't be doing that again.
Yeah. Well, the laptop I have here, I use rarely. I mean, I think I only turn it on about once a month. I've actually got 8 computers in my house. And the main one I use is actually in another room.
Right.
This laptop here, I
never
just
use. That's probably why you've never heard it urging to be moved.
No, this one here I just use for recording notes and... Generally, it just sits here on the bench, and when I need to use it, I pick it up and move it over to my table on the other side of the room there, and that's where I use it. But it just sort of sits here on the bench mostly, because my table on the other side of the room also gets used, and I keep running out of table space.
So what do you do after you get the precipitate?
Okay, once the dew water has fermented for quite a while, and you get this brown... sort of sludge across the bottom, and it's actually quite unique because it kind of clumps together and looks like little hills. Anyway.
When you say ferment, do you mean just close it up or you mean leave it open?
Yep.
Like with cotton or something?
No, it's in a flask and has a sealed lid on top that I've filled with doping wax.
Understood.
Doping wax.
Airtight.
Depending on how you pronounce it. Doping wax is used in lapidary for cutting gems. It's actually... a high temperature melting wax. So when you seal the lid onto something like that, it doesn't come off real easy. And it's completely airtight. And that one's been sitting there for a good 4 months. But I wanted to let that one sit there for 6 months before I went any further with it. Once that gur has formed down the bottom, you just siphon off the water and separate the gur. The gur itself, I then put it into a test tube. It's just a standard size test tube. It's about 15 centimeters tall, about 2 centimeters cylindrical.
Mm-hmm.
It too has a screw down lid available for it. And once I separate the gur and put it into the test tube, the test tube I actually submerge into a tropical fish tank with a heater there set to 37 degrees. And I let it sit in there until it turns black. Once it turns black, then you take the test tube out of the water and put it into a sand-based incubator.
How long might it take to turn it black?
To turn black, it generally takes about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Is that Fahrenheit or Celsius?
I work in Celsius, sorry. I don't know the Fahrenheit values. I think it's you divide by
About 95 degrees Fahrenheit.
I can calculate. I just want to know which it is.
Okay. So, yeah, the test tube submersed into the water bath, which is a tropical fish tank with a tropical fish tank heater, just a 55-watt one. That one's set to 37.5 degrees Celsius. I have to top up the fish tank every week because it tends to evaporate the water out. But as long as that test tube remains submersed, which basically is submersed in there by me tying lead to it and keeps it down the bottom, and, yeah, let it sit there for about 6 weeks until it turns black. Generally about 5 weeks, actually. About 5 to 6 weeks. It varies, which is strange. These solutions that you work with often do vary in the amount of time. So it's best just to look at it. And when you look at it and you see it's gone jet black, you know it's ready, irrespective of how long it took.
Do you attribute this blackness, Michael?
Sorry?
What do you believe is the causative effect of this blackness?
I believe it's a mineral oxide.
Oxide?
Yep, most mineral oxides are black. If you take a look at the electroplating shop link that I sent on the Ormus SWG group, you'll notice that they sell platinum oxide, and platinum oxide is a black powder.
Mm.
Most
okay.
mineral oxides are black, hence black sand.
Here, one interesting thing is that on, I think it was on your call last week that we had a little speech from Sigverta, who talked about the cosmic dust that's attracted towards the sun that we collect at night. And do you believe that effectively what you've got is precipitated cosmic dust?
Correct. That's what I pretty much say it's going to be, along with any other mineral ions that happen to be floating in the atmosphere at the time that the clouds formed and then precipitated down as dew.
What about just carbon from the plant?
If there were carbon in it, then the gur itself would have black specks in it. And carbon mixes with oxygen quite well to form a carbon dioxide, which is a gas. And as your dew water is fermenting, it does bubble. And I'm assuming it's carbon dioxide.
Okay. Once you get it to that point, once it's black, what do you do?
Ah, yes. Yes, moving forward. It's in the test tube. It's black. I've taken it out of the fish tank. I've then put it into a sand-based incubator, which is basically a big stainless steel bucket I've got here with a heating element under it, and it's full of sand. I bury the test tube into the sand, and I set the incubator to 43 degrees Celsius, and I let it sit in there for about 8 to 10 weeks.
And it's still sealed?
Yeah, it's still sealed. Haven't added anything to it. It's still sealed in that test tube. And after that period, it turns white. Actually, if you dig it out too early, it's a slight off-grey colour. Just put it back in. Keep it in there until it goes snow white. And once you have got it to that snow white point, you'll probably only, well, in my experience, you generally have less than a gram left. And it's a very bright white powder in the test tube that when you put your hand near it, it moves away from your hand.
Now,
and it's actually difficult to work with.
The test tube has been sealed the whole time.
Yes.
If you wanted it to fly a little more, you might want to use a larger test tube?
You could. Unfortunately, my incubator is probably not big enough to fit a bigger one.
Mm-hmm.
And considering that, you know, I'm only working with 2 liters of dew water to start with, the amount of gur that I'm getting isn't that much.
Right.
I'd say there's probably, I don't know, 2, maybe 3 grams of gur around the bottom.
On the other hand, you can't tell with such a small test tube how far it's gonna move from your hand.
If I dig the test tube out of the fan and hold it in my hand, no matter where my hand is, the powder will be at the other end.
Right.
But what's happened to the rest of the contents in the test tube, Michael?
It's gone. I don't know what happens to it. It just disappears.
Yeah, but where does it go?
Well,
it's a sealed test tube, right?
Completely, yes. It's Pyrex, has a sealed top.
So it's sneaking out through the glass?
I have no idea.
It's sneaking out through the lid?
It converts itself to ether. How's that?
Yeah, right.
Actually,
this is Michael Burberry magic.
I think what's more probable is the mineral oxide that's in there, as it digests in the incubator, it actually compacts into itself.
Now, if you put it in a liter jar and you put your hand under it, you'd know that it would go up the height of the liter jar.
I don't know. I've only ever worked with smaller amounts, and
right.
It takes such a long time.
Well, the problem as I see it is you don't know which way it's, how far it can jump, how strong this anti-gravity effect is. And
no,
that would be useful to know, I think.
I have absolutely no idea, and to be honest, I only do things on very small scale. I don't have the means to scale it up.
Do you take that orally then?
I haven't taken it. It's still there.
Well, here's my question: is why would you go through this process? What's the added value? What's the significant end benefit?
Well, actually, I found an old alchemical track that actually showed me how to do it. The main thing I wanted to see was the track correct? Is it possible? Can it be done? And actually doing it, to me, is 99% of the fun. The end product, I'll probably end up throwing out.
No, well, just throw it in my direction. I'll give you my poster address and I'll be the guinea pig.
Yes, sir.
This is Arlene. Hi.
Hi,
I just
Arlene.
Was wondering, how long does it take you to collect 2 liters of dew? That seems like you're putting a lot of energy into all of this, and then you're going to throw it out?
Eh? It takes me one night.
One night?
Yeah. I posted on the list how to collect you.
Oh, okay.
It's actually really quite simple.
Go over it again, Michael.
Yeah. Okay. The quickest way to collect you, and you've probably all seen this, you grab a cold can, you go put it in the fridge. When you take it out of the fridge and you put it on the windowsill, the water condensates around the edge of it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's seen that. So what you do is you grab freezer packs, you know those blue freezer packs that you use in Eskies, or I don't know what they call them in the US, we call them Eskies, portable fridges. Yes.
Cold packs.
Sorry, chillers, there you go. those blue freezer packs, you put like a dozen of them in the freezer and let them freeze, and then on the full moon, you take them outside and you string them up with a nylon fishing line. Just hang them off the edge of the house, and under each one just put a cup, and basically the midnight dew will condensate around those frozen packs and drip down into the cup, and you'll collect 2 liters in one night, easy.
Thank you.
Okay.
I imagined you running around taking dew off of grass leaves.
Oh, no. I'm not like the old alchemist running around with a cape around my neck over long grass and then wringing out the cape. And whilst that
isn't
sounds
that
quite
caper?
Exciting to do, particularly on the full moon, I don't think the neighbours would appreciate it.
There goes that witchy poo Michael Burberry again.
Speaking of dew, do you still have the material that you did the last time?
Yes.
And does it still levitate?
Oh, that's a good question. Picking it up.
Well, if it's that heavy, it probably doesn't.
Some of it, not all of it.
Uh-huh.
How long has it been?
It's been at least 2 months. At least. Probably longer.
And where was it stored?
On my shelf here.
In an open glass. I mean, in a glass tube.
It's still in the test tube. I haven't unsealed it yet.
Uh-huh.
Well, would somebody with a video camera or a camera with a video mode get a short video of that stuff levitating around in the tube, please?
I'll see what I can arrange.
You're going to be having a meeting pretty soon, eh?
Yeah,
in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, good.
And my plan is to go and hang out with the esteemed Michael Burberry and pick his brains mercilessly.
I better bring them then.
So has, this is Abdul Hai again, has someone eaten the dew to test the qualities of that particular ointment?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Have you eaten the dew precipitate to test the qualities of the ointment and compare it?
No,
to
it's still in the test tube. I haven't touched it.
I'll touch it when I get down there.
Sure.
You can see if I live afterwards.
That's it with your mouth.
We'll have to tie a rope to your leg just in case.
There he goes. Like a blimp.
You'll have to attach a weight to you.
Yeah.
Float away.
You know, they say that angels fly because they take themselves lightly. We don't want to just be floating off here.
So tell us more about the peroxide process.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. We're moving along in time, so I'd like to talk now about the hydrogen peroxide and hydrochloric acid process. One of the most stubborn metals I've ever worked with is copper. Copper is just one of those ones that just doesn't want to convert very easily. And generally, this type of process is only successful about 1 in 10 times. So you could be sitting there trying this, and it just doesn't work. And basically, you end up starting again, and you end up doing it 10 times before you can get that copper to turn into a white powder. I do think copper is actually a very good one to start with, not just because it's so stubborn and teaches you the method quite well, but it's also quite a cheap metal and it's easy to get. I would not generally recommend using copper coins. Copper coins generally are intermixed with lead and are then cyanide treated to make them hard.
Mm.
So try and steer away from copper coins in that respect. The best copper to get is actually a LAN cable that you get for computers. You go down to a shop and you can buy a meter LAN cable for a computer for about $3 and then just pull the copper out of it and you've got plenty, a lot more than what you would with coins.
Oh yeah.
And that particular copper is very soft, it's very high quality, and it's designed to carry very high frequencies for computers, so the copper is actually very pure. And you'll see that it's got a real bright copper shiny color to it as well.
And you call it a LAN cable?
Yeah, LAN cables for computers.
Okay.
What you wire your computer up to networks.
Okay.
I'm lucky. I work for an ISP. They cable things all the time. So I grab the offcuts out of the bin. I got boxes of it.
Yeah.
So I got plenty of copper to play with. Okay, so moving on to this process, I have a Pyrex beaker here. This particular beaker is 250 mL. Into that, I put in my hydrochloric acid, but before I do that, this particular hydrochloric acid I get from an electroplating shop, it's 70%. It's actually quite strong. Most hydrochloric acid you'll get on the market is 30%. So if there is an electroplating factory around near you, their hydrochloric acid is actually very strong, and it's actually quite good for this process. But the first thing I'll do with that hydrochloric acid is I put it into a bottle, and I stick it on the roof at dawn so it gets sunlight onto it. And it's just a clear bottle, clear glass bottle that you put the hydrochloric acid in, and put it up there on the roof and let it get sunlight for the whole day. So at dusk, you go and collect the bottle off the roof, that hydrochloric acid has been in the sun all day in a sealed bottle, okay? That actually makes the hydrochloric acid rather more reactive for reasons that I haven't been able to determine yet. Though secluded loves the idea. And he wondered where I got the idea, and the idea actually came from yet another old alchemical tract where the particular alchemist, whose name was Paracelsus, would put out his acid in the sun and solarize his acids before he used it because Paracelsus said it made the acids much better. So I tried it. I put it up there on the roof, left it out there all day, brought it back, and found out I used literally half the amount of hydrogen peroxide to get the same reaction. So whatever the sun is doing to the hydrochloric acid, which is beyond me, it does make it much more reactive. So 120 mil of hydrochloric acid into the 250 mil beaker, and then I take about 1 gram of the copper that I've filed down with just a normal nail file to a fine dust. I generally just measure out about 1.5 grams and put that into the 120 mil of hydrochloric acid. Now, at that stage, it's not really doing much. It just sort of sinks to the bottom and doesn't do anything. And that's when I take my hydrogen peroxide, and I do the same freezing process that I do with the vinegar. I stick the hydrogen peroxide into the freezer and let it freeze, and then again, just pour out what doesn't freeze. The hydrogen peroxide that doesn't freeze is much more reactive, and then it's basically I use a 5 mil syringe. I draw up about 2 mil at a time, and then very slowly, while stirring it quite briskly, and also stir it with a Pyrex rod. Don't use any metal, and I don't recommend using wood either, so use a Pyrex rod or glass rod if you can, and stir it round quite briskly, and just put in 1 or 2 drops at a time, and then let it stand for a while, about 10 minutes, and then do it again. Keep repeating that very slow process of dropping in the hydrogen peroxide,
now,
and it will start bubbling.
The hydrogen peroxide, you're starting with hydrogen peroxide from the chemist, right?
Correct.
From the drugstore.
That's right.
It isn't the 35% that
three.
Started with.
It's 3%.
3%. But when you've frozen it, you concentrate it, so it's a lot higher than 3%.
Yes. After the freezing process, I'd say it's probably closer to 60 or 70% because most of that solution is water or some sort of filler that they use. Okay. And when you freeze it, that filler freezes and the hydrogen peroxide doesn't.
Really tricky.
Yeah. And yet, very simple.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I notice you seem to like simple.
Do you add salt?
Not at that stage.
Uh-huh.
No, at that stage, I'm just dropping it in and getting it to start bubbling and get the copper to dissolve into the hydrochloric acid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And once you get it to start bubbling, the copper starts disappearing, you're stirring it around, and you're seeing the copper dust down the bottom. It generally goes into the middle of the cyclone that you're creating in the beaker. And you'll see it will very slowly start to dissipate, and the solution will bubble, and the bubbles are basically hydrogen as well, so keep well away from any flames because hydrogen is highly explosive.
And you'll be getting a lot of chlorine gas as well.
Actually, no, it doesn't smell like chlorine at all.
Really?
Yeah. I would say it is predominantly hydrogen gas.
Because I get a lot of chlorine when I use 35% hydrochloric and 35% peroxide.
You get quite a strong chlorine smell?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Huh. No,
you're going quite quiet, Barry.
I'm too quiet?
Yes.
Okay.
No, in my beaker, I don't get much of a chlorine smell at all.
Uh-huh.
You don't notice it. But then I generally keep quite away because I know it's hydrogen gas basically coming off, and breathing hydrogen gas isn't terribly good for you.
No.
Why is that?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but apparently it reduces the oxygen in your brain.
Ah, we can't have that.
No, apparently it's not good for you at all.
But
when I'm doing this, I actually have a fan behind me and a flute in front of me. So whilst I'm stirring around and putting in the hydrogen peroxide, there's an airflow going behind me, pushing it forward, and a flute in front of me sucking it out and taking it outside.
Yeah.
So I guess
why
I don't
know anything.
Given
you like simplicity, how have you set that up?
Well, okay, there's a fan on the ground there that I turn on.
Yeah, got that part.
The flute is basically just a box made out of plastic that has a fan on the other end. that basically just sucks the air away from you and pushes it outside. Just a tube.
Okay, so it's up against a window or something.
It's actually up against the edge of the garage, and the tube just runs out the door.
Okay.
Okay.
I knew it would be something simple like that.
It's not terribly difficult, but it was a little expensive. But I think, you know, if you're going to be working with solutions like this, you want to be safer than sorry.
Yeah.
Anyway, whilst dropping in the hydrogen peroxide, it does get a little bit warm, but as long as you do it slowly, it actually remains quite cool. And once all the copper has completely disappeared and you can't see any more copper down the bottom of your solution as you're stirring it around, keep going with the hydrogen peroxide. Don't stop. Just keep going and keep getting it to the solution to bubble and
because
slow down the stirring.
Because as long as it's bubbling, it's reacting.
Yeah.
Ah.
So you keep dropping it in for a good 10 to 15 minutes after all the copper's gone, and that's when it will finally stop bubbling. And at that point, it's ready.
And ready for what, buddy? I mean, what is the end purpose?
Well,
what is the major significant benefit that someone would go through that process for?
Well, this is the conversion of a tea metal to ormus. I always thought it was Don Nance that wrote it up, but Barry might correct me on that.
Don Nance wrote it up.
I
wrote it up first, and then Don Nance modified it and improved it and wrote it up again.
Yeah.
And so, way does this particular ormus have any noticeable effect, if any? What's the benefit?
That's the interesting question, because I generally don't consume it.
Don't tell me you don't even eat it.
No. I just like making it. So,
ladies and gentlemen, we have extraordinary, unusual alchemist here who doesn't even eat his own products.
I like the salt. Don't get me wrong, I love the salt. I think it's fantastic. And I've made the copper ormus. I've made several other metals through the exact same procedure. And I've tasted it, but I didn't like it. That's what it came down to.
Copper is...
So basically, you're copying all these old alchemical practices.
And the hydrogen peroxide one like Don Nance did.
Copper seems to be helping my beard to come back to its original color and keeping my hair from getting gray.
There you go. And yet, a lot of people don't realize there's copper in the salt.
Well, sure. A lot of people also don't realize that there's copper in the air. There's a considerable amount of copper in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim has actually trapped copper. He says the main ormus components in the air are silver and copper with a bit of gold, which surprised
me. And I'd agree with that. But the point of doing the hydrochloric acid and hydrogen peroxide method is not just because I enjoy doing it, but also to show the case that it is actually possible to convert these metals to their equivalent in white powder.
Yes.
And that then in turn proves that the salt contains it already in those white powders.
Okay, so do you have any of this copper white powder for me to try when I come down?
Good question. Let me have a look.
Did you finish the process, or?
No. At that point, once you've finished dropping in the hydrogen peroxide, I follow Don Nance's written-up procedure, which is on Barry's site. So Barry, if you would like to forward those links to people that ask, that'd be appreciated.
Sure.
But the procedure from there is basically a pH swing procedure. And Don Nance used hydrochloric acid. I did it with the hydrochloric acid as well. It works quite well. But I've also done it with vinegar, the white wine vinegar, frozen, same procedure, and it works quite well as well.
See, I think the yogis like the copper because they always talk about copper plating your navel.
Mm-hmm. That's where I think the Himalayan salt, the pink Himalayan salt that you can get, even though it's quite expensive, that the reason it's predominantly pink is because of iron and copper. And it's actually very high in content of copper.
Wow.
So for those that want to do the salt precipitate method, the Himalayan salt is actually very high in iron and copper and is actually a very good one to use.
Excellent.
But not my personal preference, mainly because it's expensive.
Now, I have a slightly off-topic commentary sort of question for you, Michael. In your conscious understandings, and in terms of your conscious motivation, besides your alchemical curiosity, do you get a significant uplift in levels of consciousness from doing this stuff in your garage?
Oh, most
my
definitely.
My dowsing says yes, but I'm interested in hearing your opinion.
Most definitely. I do have my salt precipitate every day. It gives me a great deal of energy, and I do expend a lot of that energy doing these processes in my garage, and I enjoy it. I really do love it. And I don't always eat the products, and you know, quite often I am throwing it out, much to the dismay of probably everyone on this call. But, yeah, I put the copper precipitates on plants outside. They're all going rampant. I have
so,
to get a
so you're not
chainsaw
throwing
out
it out. You're throwing it out on your garden.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I got carrots growing in the backyard. They're coming along lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Though the weather we've been having lately has been extremely hot, so they're kind of wiltering a bit.
Mm.
The trees, I got small pine trees I bought and planted along the back fence. They're all well over 6 foot now. They were only like 2 foot about 3 months ago.
Oh, wow.
So they're going rampant, and I'm going to have to get a chainsaw out and start hacking them back a bit because they're going very quickly. And like I said, I've stopped putting it on my lawn because I got sick of mowing it. And
have you tasted any of your carrots yet?
Sorry?
Have you tasted any of your carrots yet?
Yes, I have.
How do
very
they taste?
Very sweet. Very sweet. Especially the center. The center of the carrot gets this very sugary, sweet taste to it.
It tastes sort of like carrot juice without even juicing them, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I've noticed. I've even organic carrots anymore in the U.S., they kind of taste like cardboard. They're no good. But Ormus carrots are just so wonderful and sweet.
Yeah, I was very surprised at how sweet they were. And
yeah.
That's why I'm still continuing growing them out the back there.
Mm-hmm.
But I got two children as well, and they run out and pull them up and eat them. So they generally don't get to maturity.
There you go.
This is Marty again, and I have a question about the watering, using the wash water or whatever to water your plants. It seems like since it's so high in sodium that it might kind of burn. Is that not true, or do you dilute the solution?
Okay. When you do the salt precipitate and you take that water off, I don't feed that water to the plants because that is actually very high in pH. But the first wash water, the pH is generally around 9.5, and the plants seem to handle that quite well.
Okay, thanks.
So I tend to spray it around, and I water the garden as well, so I guess that is diluting it down as well.
Okay.
So
okay.
What I'm picking up from this, Michael, is that you are doing an enormous amount of upliftment of consciousness in your space by doing these amazing processes. And in fact, it seems to me, to be the significant payback for you in the invisible realm.
Oh, yes. I mean, like
one of the things that I noticed very quickly is, and so I've posted about this quite a few times, and some of you may have read them, is whenever you make almost in your place, the level of consciousness in your place will jump significantly to the point where people will come to visit you and they won't want to leave. And, you know, I've had occasions where it's got to 3:30 in the morning and people are still sitting on my couch and I'm going, well, I'm going to go to bed now. They go, oh, look how late it is. I kid you not. People
That's
just don't want
what
to
I
leave.
Say is, why don't I go to bed so you guys can leave?
One of the things I found quite fascinating was on Dr. Maluski's site, where he was saying ormus is a gas. And to be honest with you, when you do these processes yourself in your own room, you do feel very energized. It's difficult to explain. So I do think it is possible that the ormus is actually gassing away in my garage and I'm in here with it.
Wow.
That wasn't so difficult to explain.
Oh, there you go.
So is there anything else? Look, there's got to be some questions you guys are having out there in the real world. So why don't you, if you're muted, unmute yourself and speak up.
Michael, do you? Oh, excuse me.
Go ahead.
Do you work with traps? You know, the traps at all? Magnetic traps?
I do have some magnetite that I use with water, very similar to what Mr. Maluski talked about. And I am building a device that I'm waiting for magnets with, but otherwise, no. Though I have an old water trap that I made quite some time ago, but I generally don't use that either, mainly because the stream that I used to go and trap has dried up. It's very dry here. But no,
you're going to have to start doing some weather invocations, Michael, because we're getting rain almost every second day.
Yeah, send some mail away. We haven't seen rain in months.
Well, here's something you can just start doing. This is my recipe for creating weather. Just start announcing the kind of weather you're going to have. As if you're quoting a weather report to your neighbours, and do it to anyone who's around. Just say, you know, it's hot now, but it's going to start, the drought's going to break. In fact, the drought is breaking any time now, and we're going to go back to having, and then you describe the kind of weather you want. And that's, I've just been doing that for a while now, and that's what we get is clear mornings, cloudy and windy in the afternoon, and more often than not, rain at night.
Well, one thing I will say is putting the ormus wash water out on the vegetation I have out the back, that vegetation needs a lot less water. I mean, I don't water it very often, mainly because we're on water restriction, and those plants, they're growing rampantly, and they're not getting much water at all.
That's very interesting, because other people have reported that they need more water to grow, but that it makes it more drought tolerant. Now, that seems like a contradiction, and so it's interesting that you're saying that they need less water. That's great.
Well, it's mainly down to the fact that we're on water restrictions. You're not allowed to water your plants at the moment.
Yeah.
Mainly because the dam up behind Sydney is just drying up. And, I put my wash water on them to, you know, try and help keep them alive. But they are still growing very well.
Well, you'll find that dam will start filling up soon, buddy. You watch.
Hope so.
You're going to start getting regular, intermittent, but regular rain without flooding. You know what I mean? Just nice, extra regular, medium level rain. And the whole Wallangamba Dam will be full up.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Water restrictions will be something in the past. Anyone else got any questions?
Marcus in Germany. I had a series of questions. I'm Dennis. Michael, you mentioned the red tincture and the red line. Did you do both or just one?
I did NDC specific red line, the red powder.
The red line, not the red tincture?
Correct.
So do you know if it had a radioisotope or not?
I don't have a Geiger counter, so no, I wouldn't know.
Oh, okay. You also mentioned that you did something differently. You cheated on it?
Yes.
On the procedure?
Nick says to use nitric acid and hydrochloric and mix it into aqua regia.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, waste of time.
That's it,
Okay. If you'd use the hydrochloric hydrogen peroxide, and actually put in small amounts of purified salt into that as you're going,
mm-hmm.
you get the clear gold chloride much faster, and there's no nitric acid, so you don't have to worry about nitrogen being left over in the whole process. So yes, I cheat.
Oh, okay. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to ask, if you start with a clear nano-cola gold, colloidal gold, at what stage would you start to try to perform the red line?
Once you get the clear gold chloride, in his specific procedure, you need mm-hmm. to then get it to the green line. You need to get the gold chloride to become green, which is through a digestion stage.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I needed to repeat that stage 3 times before it turned green.
Okay.
He says you need to do it once. It took me 3 times before it turned green. So you put in the 2 grams of salt, you stick it in your incubator, you let it digest for the 21 days, you take it out and it hasn't changed. You put in another 2 grams of salt, seal it, put it back. Had to do it 3 times before it went green.
Okay. Okay, but if you started with colloidal gold, and yet it was a clear nano-colloidal gold, how would you get from there to the... Do you have to go to the gold, to the clear chloride, or do you have to skip that?
Once you got the clear gold chloride, it's just a matter of adding the salt and digesting it.
Uh-huh. So you can basically start with colloidal gold. Colloidal, not chloride.
I don't think so. It needs to be a gold chloride because the green line is actually very fine gold chloride.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it looks green.
Oh,
it
okay.
needs to be a chloride.
Is there a possibility of ever using colloidal gold?
I haven't tried it, and I doubt it would work. It's different. Colloidal gold is just metallic gold ions suspended in a solution. And the solution is generally an alcohol-based solution as well. To get the red line, as Nick has pointed out, it needs to be a gold chloride. And, I mean, you can cheat. You can just go straight to that electroplating shop that I posted up and buy the gold chloride in the clear solution ready to start digesting. You don't have to actually work with gold to start with. You can cheat in the process.
Oh, I see.
But if you buy the gold chloride from that electroplating factory, you still need to break it down further with some hydrogen peroxide until it stops bubbling. Clusters break up well before you add the salt and start digesting it.
Okay. And that link was posted in Ormitz SWG?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So,
but,
Michael, we've got a couple of emails with some questions.
Sure.
One of them is, how do you make an extraction from quartz, milky or rosy, that Philip is interested in that process?
Okay.
And not in what is written by John Reed, because he said, I know Michael changed something. And
yes.
Step two, question two is, how did he use electrolysis to extract gold from quartz? A step-by-step procedure, please.
Okay. Well, we've still got a few minutes, so let's try and do this very quickly.
Okay.
Quartz is actually a very tough material to work with, but if you put it into a stainless steel pan and heat it up at maximum heat until it gets really red hot and then drop it into cold distilled water, the quartz will actually fracture and start coming apart, and that releases what was in the quartz into the water.
Ah, tricky.
Okay. So you repeat that process over and over. Just keep really heating up that quartz until it's, like, really red hot and drop it into cold water.
Smaller, smaller clumps.
Yeah, and it keeps breaking apart and breaking apart and breaking apart. And you keep repeating that process about 30 times. After about 30 times, you'll be left with very small glass-like fractures of the quartz. And they're very sharp, too, so be careful with them. So then put a filter over the water and filter off the water and keep that aside because that's used later. And then you use the pestle and mortar because by that time the quartz is very fragile and very brittle. And you can literally grind it up into a powder using a pestle and mortar.
Yep.
And then you can proceed with John Reed's process exactly as he's written it. I'm skipping forward here because of lack of time.
Yep.
And basically it's a digestion,
and distillation. But the alkahest, when he talks about the alkahest, the vegetable alkahest, you don't need to use that. You can use the water that you actually fractured the quartz in and use that as your alkahest and just keep proceeding with exactly what he wrote. So you don't have to go through all the hassle of making the vegetable alkahest from wine.
Okay, so
you
I don't know what he wrote. Could you just quickly bring us up to speed on that?
Sorry?
I don't know what he wrote, so would you give us a quick overview on that?
What's the guy's name? John who?
John Reed.
On the alkahest.
Okay, I'm just swinging around to my computer here. It was on levity.com/alchemy.
Levity.com/alchemy.
Yep. And scroll down to the Practical Alchemy on the left. John Reed's course on plant alchemy. Oil of Rose Quartz, number 6 of part 2.
Okay. Number 6 of part 2.
Okay, and he says here, down as you scroll down, take 1 pound of rose quartz and break it up into pieces the size of quarters, which you don't really need to do because you can buy it generally in small pieces. Place the pieces in a crucible and heat them at 600 to 800 degrees centigrade for 1 hour. In other words, make them real red hot. Then using a pair of tongs, take them out and drop them into water. Okay? And then he says to basically repeat that. Place the crucible in a kiln, blah, blah, blah.
Okay,
after numerous times, you'll see the quartz has begun to turn white. It does. It becomes very brittle and goes a white color. Okay, even rose quartz will go white. But the water you've been dropping it in will actually start taking on a slight pink color.
Okay.
Skipping forward, be careful of the sharp bits. Yeah, grind the quartz to a white powder. Place the ground quartz into an Erlenmeyer flask and pour over it your alkahest. Now, that sentence where he says actually place the quartz in an Erlenmeyer flask and pour over the alkahest, all you need to do is break up that quartz into a powder, put it into a sealable flask, and then basically top it up to 2/3 full with the water that you were dropping the crystals into.
Okay, yep, good.
Okay?
Yep.
All right. Place a cork, basically you seal it, and then you put the flask into an incubator at 40 degrees, for 4 to 6 weeks. I found it generally takes about 8 to 10 weeks. Okay, so basically whatever he said there, double it, because that's really how long it takes. Now, he says 40 degrees centigrade. I run my incubator at 43 degrees centigrade. I left it in there for a good 10 weeks.
And what's the significant added value reason for doing this?
Well, he says at the end of this time, your solution will be a light yellow to dark orange. I found it didn't really go to the yellowish orange color until after that amount of time. And I think that's the point of when you're doing these types of processes. You're not so worried about the recipe of how long things take. You need to actually look at it and make sure it does change to the colors that are specified. And if it hasn't, put it back in. Let it go longer. Okay? All right.
What I'm saying
once it
is,
has
what's
gone
the added value reason for doing this?
Sorry?
What's it used for?
Ah. See, this particular process is called the oil of rose quartz. Basically, after you have digested it in the incubator for a period of time and it has changed color, the mineral elements of the quartz have leached into the solution. That's what happens when things ferment and break down. They leach into the solutions, all their minerals.
Yep.
Okay? Then he says, set the...
Does this stuff have a specific application?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
All right? Then he says to set the flask in a cool place for 2 weeks, which is right. You just let it sit there and just basically just cool down for a period of about 2 weeks. I only left mine for about 5 days. I got impatient. Then you break the seal and basically filter off the liquid, okay? You only want the liquid. You don't want any of the crystals that are left in the bottom. You only want that nice yellowish-orange-type liquid. It is like a very... It's like someone grabbed a can of Fanta and poured it into a big flask and then topped it up with water. It's a very light, pale orange color.
Yep.
Okay? Moving forward... You then place that liquid into a distillation flask.
basically, at this point, we're going to distill it very slowly. Okay, so, I mean, I'm lucky I have a very good distillation set up here. It cost me in excess of $500. Though it is technically possible to do it with cheaper things. And I've done it myself using Heineken bottles and a tube. So you can go and do these types of things on the cheap as well. But yeah, when you have good equipment, it makes life so much easier. Okay. Basically that, distillation flask is then put in a water bath, which is again my tropical fish tank set at 37.5 degrees Celsius, and very slowly distill it. Okay. After it's distilled over and you got the liquid from the phlegm that's left in the distillation flask, I then pour the distillate back onto the phlegm and distill it again and repeat that process 7 times. After the 7th time that you've done this, actually generally after about the 4th or 5th time, you'll start seeing a layer of oil form over the top of the phlegm left in the distillate flask, the stuff that doesn't distill over. But when you've done it about 7 times, that oil becomes a nice, quite large layer around the actual liquid that's left in the bottom. And it can be a very dark colour, but it can vary in colour as well, depending on what crystal you use. With the milky quartz, it's actually a very light, pale, milkish colour. But with the rose quartz, it's actually quite a deep, brownish sort of colour. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so once you've distilled it the 7th time, I then use a syringe with a needle on it, and I tilt the flask over, and using the syringe with a needle on it, I draw the oil off what's left in the bottom of that distillate flask, and then put it into a test tube. I then leave the test tube basically just covered with a coffee filter so it can air, and just let it sit there and dry until it forms the powder. Now, the powder of rose quartz, which is predominantly copper, is actually a light grayish sort of color, and in my opinion is most probably copperormous, and depending on what crystal you use in that process will be the type of powder that you get. If you use the milky quartz, which is predominantly gold, then the white powder that you're left over with is predominantly goldormous.
Ah, that's quite a cheap way to make goldormous then.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's cheaper ways. You can just buy dead sea salt and precipitate that.
And so, yes, second question is, how do you use electrolysis to extract gold from quartz?
Aha. If you use the milky quartz and do this process, and you separate out that white, whitish, oily liquid, okay, I then put that whitish, oily liquid into a cyanide-based, potassium cyanide-based solution, and then you mix in muriatic acid to bring the pH down to, I believe it was 9.2. It needs to be 9.2, and the solution needs to be run at 25 degrees Celsius, or between 22 and 25 degrees Celsius, which is optimal for gold plating. And then you put in your anode and cathode, connect it up to some car batteries, and electroplate away.
Well, far out.
Dangerous chemicals, though, you want to be careful.
Again?
It's dangerous chemicals, so you want to be careful.
Now, is it difficult to convert from ormus to metal using electroplating process?
The white powders will dissolve quite readily in a cyanide-based solution because it's an alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And once it does dissolve into that alcohol-style solution, in this case a potassium cyanide solution, which is used for gold leaching anyway, if you look at a gold mine, when they do gold leaching with cyanide, they then run the cyanide through activated carbon filters and the gold forms on the activated carbon. In this case, it's very similar. That instead of using activated carbon, I'm using basically lead rods and electrolysis and just electroplating the ions of gold straight out of the solution. But it needs a lot of amps.
Is it a cost-effective
Not much voltage,
way to get...
a lot of amps. Sorry, someone asked a question?
Is it a cost-effective way to get gold or not?
No. No. If there was, I wouldn't be working anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I honestly have not found a cost-effective way of recovering metals yet. It's actually quite expensive.
Yeah, that was my last closing question, because we've just got a couple of minutes left on the call, buddy. You know how there have been a number of
stories about different salt sources and various other sources that have really high rhodium in them. And you know, given that rhodium is like a few grand an ounce, surely the amazing Michael Burberry has gone, how can I get that out into some metal and sell it and not have to even work for GE anymore?
Well, for one, you've got to worry about whom you're going to sell it to, because they're going to ask questions. And
yeah,
two, it's just not cost effective.
Ah.
The amount of power that you use in electroplating is enormous. And like I said, I've got 12 car batteries down there. So it's only 12 volt, but we're looking at 12 times 50 amps. It's actually a lot of power. And it drains those batteries when you do it. So I've got to charge them up again, and that takes days. And my electricity bill goes through the roof.
But this would work well as an assay method, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
As a what?
If you wanted to get the metal assayed to see what content of what metals were in it.
Assay method, yeah.
Have you done such a thing with Horizon Salt, is it?
I did. I actually sent some samples off to Genelysis, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke their machine, so they don't want to talk to me anymore.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, their ICP MS
mm-hmm.
actually heated up the sample to 8,000 degrees Kelvin.
Yeah.
A fairly large portion of the sample did not ionize at that temperature and clogged up the gun that fires it through the magnetic field so they can measure it, and they ended up having to get the equipment basically replaced.
Now, this wasn't stuff that was converted to metal.
No.
So
this was just the salt precipitate.
If you converted it to metal first and then sent that for assay, that would give us...
I'd like to, but they won't talk to me anymore for some unknown reason. But, yeah, I will look around. The other thing I didn't quite like is they said the minimum amount they needed to do an assay was 120 grams.
Mm.
I can't scale things up that big to produce that much. It would take me over a year just to produce 120 grams of metal to go and get assayed.
Wow. Well, I heard that somebody had a bunch of white powder and they were arrested. The authorities took the white powder and ran it through the assay machine and it gummed it right up. I mean, it did what you said.
Yeah, basically when the sample is analyzed, they put the sample inside a special kiln that
mm-hmm.
heats it up to 8,000 degrees Celsius, Kelvin, 8,000 degrees Kelvin, and basically every known element that is on the periodic table will vaporize at that temperature. And then as it vaporizes, they pump it through a gun that fires the ions through a magnetic gate. And based on how much they deflect as they go through that gate, they can measure what type of element it was, because it will deflect based on its mass.
Yeah.
So basically, it's ICP MS, it's mass spectrography, and the amount that the atom will deflect by allows them to calculate what its mass was. Now, the problem with the Ormus was it didn't fully vaporize at 8,000 degrees Kelvin, which is extremely unusual, because every known element on the periodic table does.
Uh-huh.
But the Ormus didn't, and it clogged up the gun that fired the ions through the magnetic gate. So the gun, they actually had to replace.
It cost
thousands.
Well, there's a gentleman who has a plasma furnace that's used for garbage. They're literally burning garbage in this plasma furnace. And they've found that when they're done, there is something left, 10,000 degrees, there's something left that doesn't burn. It doesn't vaporize.
Yep.
It is a liquid. It shows up at the bottom, and it's a green glass. I have some of that green glass. Jim assayed it and said that it's definitely Ormus platinate.
Yeah, it defies known science because it just doesn't vaporize at that temperature.
Right.
And yeah, the poor people at Genelysis, I mean, it cost them a fortune to prove that to me.
Uh-huh.
And since then, they don't particularly want to talk to me.
They obviously didn't send you the bill.
No, they didn't bill me at all. They said they don't know what it is, and they're not willing to find out anymore.
No. What kind of ICP mass spec or what?
Sorry, I missed that.
What kind of analysis did they run?
ICP-MS, mass spectrography.
There you go.
Mass spectrography, they fire the ion through some form of ion gun after it's been vaporized in the chamber. And as the ions get fired through this gun, it goes through a magnetic gate. And as it goes through the magnetic gate, the ions will actually deflect a certain amount based on their mass. So they can actually measure the mass of the ions.
Michael, this is Tim. In Oklahoma and much of Arkansas, there is a special quartz that is found that is blue and green in shade. It's one of the only places that I know of where that's found. It looks much like a glass, but it actually has more of a property of quartz when you find it in its pure rock form. Do you think that there's a similarity there with what you're talking about with that green substance that won't burn?
Hard to say. I couldn't say, but generally a blue-style quartz is tin. It's tin that makes quartz go blue. And in fact, blue sapphires,
some of these are the green color, and it's almost the exact same shade as what you find in that gold chloride when you see the gold in the chloride form.
Then, is it near somewhere that may have had volcanic activity? Because, you know, things that come up from the core of the Earth can be rather hot.
It's found near ancient volcanoes, and it is often found very close to where a major fault is on the northeastern section of Arkansas. There's also diamonds that are sometimes found in placer areas. It's hard to find the diamonds because the quartz is so abundant that people pick up something shiny and think it might be a diamond. It's just quartz, but there is significant amounts of diamonds that have been found in that area too. They're just not that commercial. They're very small, not anything significant in size, but they're abundant.
Okay. Yep. As you said, it was near some volcanic action, then it is quite possible, because it does take an extreme amount of heat to make that sort of stuff. And, lava in the core of the Earth is highly pressurized. If you're finding diamonds in the same area, which can only be formed by carbon being highly pressurized under heat, then, it is actually quite possible that the green stones that you're finding up there could actually be the same glass. The only way you're really going to be able to tell, though, is to get it analyzed, and that can be interesting in itself.
I was just wondering about taking some of that and trying that the oil of quartz method that you were just describing on it.
Okay, if you do, and it is the green glass, it won't fracture when you drop it into the water.
Okay.
Okay, if it does fracture and start coming apart and forming, the white quartz, then it's not the Ormus glass. The Ormus glass won't fracture very easily at all. Sorry? Oh, yeah. Wow.
Look at the time. It's 2 hours plus.
Oh, yeah.
Just another remarkable Burberry call. Michael's saying that since he made himself the expert, well, Ice actually said that, he's getting so many emails, he's having trouble replying to them.
I'm doing as best I can, and I apologize to anyone that sent me emails that I haven't responded to. It's just the number of them. And whoever sent me an email asking me if I come and work full-time as an alchemist, the answer is no.
That concludes that one.
You need a full-time consumer to just eat your stuff.
That's okay. The plants outside love it.
Yeah, I'll come down and help you eat some of it, Michael.
And you're going to eat it eventually anyway.
From a salad.
Yep.
So listen, let's wind this up. I know I've got
a whole lot of things I need to do with my lack of Sunday morning. So, yes. Listen, I want to thank you guys for being on the call. It's been another great call. And in a couple of weeks, our guest is Chaz, the alchemist from Sedona, Priestess Alchemy. And Barry is going to be doing a workshop with him. And so they particularly wanted to have him as a guest at this time. And so we're doing that. And anyway, I'll advise you guys all on the list and so on and about that.
Chaz has seen Ormus teleport.
Say that again, Barry, please.
Chaz has seen Ormus teleport.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he'll be talking about that, I hope.
So let's call it a day. It's a day.
It's
thanks,
a day.
Dennis.
No, thank you.
Thank you,
it's
so much.
It's a rainy day in Australia.
Well, I can only hope. It's currently very hot and dry.
See you guys.